Velikovsky believes that Venus popped into this solar system 6,000 years ago. Dan, there are different theories from different people how that might have occurred, that it might have been a comet, that perhaps something smashed into Jupiter and whatever was part of that created the dust that then created Venus and all kinds of things. Do you think that could have happened?
No. Gosh, there were Babylonian astronomers who have records of Venus in its present orbit the way we see it today, long before 6,000 years ago. So that part doesn't work out too well, I don't think. But I just can't think of any mechanism that would spit out Venus out of the Jupiter system the way he'd like to. Venus is a rock and metal rich world like the Earth, and Jupiter is a gas giant planet, very rich in hydrogen and helium and gases that Venus is certainly not. So it's a very different sort of beast altogether.
Well, let's look at the rest of this universe, and then we'll get into some asteroid discussions with you, because I don't want us to get hit, Dan, and I want to make sure we're watching these things. In terms of the percents again, you know, years ago, most people would have believed, even the Catholic Church, that we are alone in the universe, even they are beginning to change their views, believing that there could be life throughout this universe. And I don't think it takes away from one's beliefs in Christianity or whatever your religion may be. If anything, it might enhance it. But I'm beginning to think also that there are bound to be planets, and I'm not going to ask you if you think they've been visiting us yet, but that there may be planets with, you know, our kind of life, intelligent life out there. They've just got to be, if you look at the percents, don't you think?
I tend to err on that particular side myself, personally. I see no reason why there wouldn't be, again, based on everything we've seen about how, you know, our solar system evolved and how we came to be on this planet. I see nothing in that would preclude there from being other intelligences out there. And again, with no hard physical evidence,
I understand,
to support it, I feel pretty confident there probably is, you know, probably are other intelligences out there, perhaps even in vast numbers, even right here in our own galaxy. I see nothing yet to preclude that.
If they were able to survive beyond the few hundred thousand years, let's assume then that
the sort of technological adolescence that we're going through right now.
Yeah,
I mean, you know how adolescents are. It's a rather difficult time in life.
Do you think, let me ask you this, if you were to put one human being on planet Earth and one human being on Mars and one human being on Saturn, assuming they all could support life, do you think over the course of the same years, give or take a thousand years, that they would all advance intelligently and technologically similarly?
Let's see. Let me pick apart. Let's think about different ways of thinking. Well, if you're talking about, okay, let's just send people in our current state out to certain places, and how do you evolve and change?
Well, let's just say we sent cavemen to every planet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess we can go back and even look just at the fossil record of life here on Earth. Just take it to its broadest base here. I think. Even though I'm very optimistic that there are going to be other intelligent life forms out there, you know, and of course the odds are, if you pick any one of them at random, just because of, you know, the timing of things,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you're going to find an intelligent race out there, it's going to be far, far advanced over us. The odds that you'd happen to find another race out there just approaching, you know, just coming out of the dark ages, if you will, coming into the light of technology at just the same state as we are, that's kind of a little bit too coincidental. But just the history of life on our own planet shows us that that evolution history is very quirky. It's like the movie It's a Wonderful Life, right? One person can touch and cascade through
everybody,
the effect
yeah.
of all, you know, many other lives. And life on Earth, the history that we see in the fossil record, shows us that it's a very quirky process. If you were to start the Earth itself, this gets, I guess, to the broadest base of your where your question was going, if you were to just start the Earth itself over again from the very beginning, somehow magically go out there and control all the knobs so that physically, chemically, you know, geologically, meteorologically, everything on the Earth were identical, but then just let the evolution of life run in its normal random process.
Right.
The roll of the die, the roll of that many dice throughout history, the odds against you rolling the same hand of dice for 4.5, 4 billion years and rolling them all identically is astronomically thin. In other words, you may well have had life on Earth evolve and change through time, but the odds that here we are, you know, 4 billion years later with these bipeds walking erect with, you know, two arms with hands with five fingers, and it, almost certainly not. So while I'm very optimistic that there are probably other life forms out there, the odds that they're going to look anything even remotely like resembling human beings, I think, are astronomically
thin. All right, but here's my question then. Do you believe all life eventually reaches the plateau of a human-type being? Is that the goal, and is that how it gets to where it is?
People's individual biases will take you in different directions. As a scientist looking at the history, again, this quirky, random history of life on Earth, I think, again, that history shows us that there really is no goal to evolution. It's a random walk through time for, you know, optimal solutions, optimal physical solutions, or close to optimal physical solutions to the engineering problems that nature throws at you. How do you, you know, you're a little insect and you want to pack in and construct a little hive of the structure, this protective structure in which to lay your eggs and raise your young. And, you know, since it takes energy, it's expensive to go out there and build these structures, you want to do it in the most efficient way possible. What's the closest packing solution you can do to use the least amount of wax to build your hive? Well, you know, this hexagonal packing structure is mathematically, physically, the optimal packing solution, and there are a lot of things like that in nature. So as I say, there are optimal solutions, but the way you arrive at those are very quirky. And so while, you know, there may be, you know, you look at how often flight has arisen on the planet independently in the insects, the mammals, the birds. I guess you could argue possibly the mammals and birds are close enough tied to each other through the vertebrate line.
Sure.
That may not be as completely independent. But again, flight, you know, the way you do it with wings that are aerodynamic, it's a, you know, again, it's one of these quote-unquote optimal solutions, but you can arrive at it from a number of different directions and come up with, you know, very, you know, dragonflies have these four kind of, you know, cellophane-like little appendages that are used to do it. How did they arrive at that? Maybe, you know, in the history of insect evolution, you had these fin-like, you know, appendages that were used for helping to cool the body, which ended up being good for flight. With birds, the feathers that evolved possibly originally on reptilian animals to regulate temperature were, you know, growing larger and used for other things that, gosh, you know, over time tended to give you lift in a way that allowed those arms to evolve into wings. So again, wings evolved by completely different architectures, but you ended up in a very similar sort of solution.
So if I'm reading,
life is quirky.
If I'm reading you right, you don't necessarily subscribe then to the thought that life will be a slam dunk where intelligent life will come at the end of the evolutionary chain.
I think that's probably a fair statement.
Okay.
It's certainly, you know, we're intelligent. We have big brains because it was a good solution to the difficulties of, you know, living in the trees where you had to pay attention to what you're doing when you're going from treetop to treetop. You evolve color vision, and of course all of the brain architecture that goes with that. Color vision is great for picking out ripe fruit versus, you know, green fruit, and the sociology involved with communicating with your neighbors, and, you know, and then later on the postures and the additional brain power that it took to live erect on a savanna. These were by no means preordained back 4 billion years ago when the planet Earth had no way to even know it was going to have savannas.
Sounds like you might be then more of a creationist than evolutionist.
No. I think just the opposite, right? I think a creationist would want to have some sort of predestined idea in mind for how things are going to end up. I mean, that's probably a gross oversimplification, but I tend to look at things in a much more, again, looking back at the history of life, it's a wonderful life, I guess, is the way to
well,
look at
I guess
it in a very quirky way.
What I'm leading to here is it possible that this kind of life, intelligent life, human life, that we may, now let's not talk about animal life and organisms on other planets, but the kind of life we have right now, you talking to me, that kind of intelligent life, well, at least intelligent coming from your end. Okay?
But I don't know sometimes.
If that kind of life may be only on this planet, is that possible?
It's possible. As I said, the physical evidence that this is the only place that we really know of, this is, you know, temporarily avoiding the UFO question that you might want to talk about later.
Yeah.
At the moment, that's the evidence we have. We are the only intelligence that we know of for sure. Do I really think that we're the only intelligent life in the whole galaxy and the whole universe? No. Do I think that we're probably the only intelligent life with two eyes and standing erect on two legs with two arms with hands that have five fingers? I think the odds that we're the only thing like that within, you know, many, 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 many hundreds or thousands of light years, I think that's probably a pretty high.
Okay, but if you then believe that there is intelligent life out there, what do you think it could look like?
Oh gosh, just about anything. As I said, I mean, look at the bizarre solutions. The bizarre.
I mean, could they look like a rock?
Gosh, you only need to go see James Cameron's Aliens of the Deep IMAX movie that's showing right now, and look at some of the absolutely bizarre and alien-looking, if you will, life forms that exist right here on our own planet, because they live in a very different environment. The cold, dark, deep depths of the abyssal ocean.
Oh, sure.
Again, you've got different engineering solutions, biological solutions to come up with for life in that sort of environment, and so you end up with life forms that look very quote-unquote alien.
And could those life forms be more intelligent than us, even if, let's say, they are forced to live in their oceans, for example?
Absolutely. I think you could end up with things that, and I'll use the word thing, that's a rather almost a derogatory way of stating it, right? But beings that look nothing at all like us, perhaps things that we would not even recognize as biological life, being incredibly intelligent. There are entire science fiction novels written around the idea of entire worlds themselves being the intelligent entity. The novel Solaris, on which
sure.
the movie is based, was sort of like that. The universe is not only more strange than we can imagine. It's crazy. I mean, I don't want to even sit there and think about what the universe can come up with. It's an amazing.
So even if they might be, you know, the universe 14 billion years old, we're 4.5 billion years.
Oh, there could be beings. There could be beings or races out there. Literally hundreds of millions, billions of years more advanced than us.
I was going to say, how long does it take a planet to develop?
You mean to actually form?
Form.
As an actual physical planet?
Yeah.
That process seemed to come to completion relatively rapidly in the formation of our own solar system. The evidence from the cosmochemistry, if you will, in the meteorites that we pick apart, it looks as though the sun started coming together as a, you know, dusty disk of material condensing in the inner portions to become warmer to form the sun. That process was going on about 4.6 billion years ago. By 4.5 billion years ago, you had essentially a fully formed Earth and the rest of the solar system in that point of view. The planetary formation process seems to take only tens to maybe at the most 100 million years or so.
That's not a lot of time.
It's a lot of time from a human perspective, but in the evolution of the solar system, it's a brief flash at the beginning, if you will, and from there on, you've got a long period of time with not a whole lot going on.
Yeah, what does a planet look like, let's say, 100 million years after it's been formed?
In the case of the Earth, not long before that, of course, as the Earth was coming together, perhaps getting to, you know, two-thirds or three-quarters of the way formed, we seem to have gone through this very massive collision with a Mars-sized other world wandering through the inner solar system during that time.
It smashed right into us, right?
Smashed through us to make our moon.
And
most of that object, you know, accreting with the Earth to meld into its core to contribute to the most of the material of the Earth. But that process formed the moon. So, you know, 100 million years into the formation of the Earth, you've probably still got a very warm planet with a what we sometimes refer to as a magma ocean. Essentially, picture the lava lakes covered with a thin rocky crust that you see in the centers of some of the floors of the volcanoes in Hawaii. Most of us have seen that sort of footage of this, you know, this glowing lake of lava with these plates of rock floating around. Imagine almost the entire surface of the Earth looking like that.
When did the water start rolling in?
Again, the evidence for that seems to be almost as soon as the Earth's surface was cool enough for that water to condense on the surface. One of the main outgassing products from volcanoes today even is water vapor. And certainly in the early Earth with many, you know, remnant ice and water-rich asteroids and comets still accreting to the Earth, bringing in a lot of that water. It now looks as though actually most of the Earth's water probably came from water-rich asteroids, not from comets. We see evidence from the few comets that we've measured It's a lot of water.
A lot of water if they dumped it on us. I mean, this planet had to have made some of its own, don't you think?
The whole planet was, in a sense, dumped upon, if you will. The planet itself grew through that very accretion process. So,
some people think that Mars had so much water, and that, here's another theory, the water from Mars, which is probably gone, other than what might be in its permafrost, that it's over here now. Somehow it just went through the miles. Maybe Mars was closer, they think. Maybe Mars might have been that planet that collided with us. Who knows? But is it possible that water could go through the universe and end up here from Mars?
Oh, we swap rocks with Mars all the time. It's a little harder to get stuff off of the Earth to deliver to Mars, but we do get meteorites from Mars.
Could we have gotten oceans?
Probably not an ocean's worth of water. There's, you know, again, probably in this, you know, what we understand about the formation of the early solar system, Mars probably formed relatively, you know, close to where it is, you know, as we see it today. You know, things were wandering around a little bit in the solar system in those early days, but, not quite that much. Mars probably got its own delivery of water from its own collisions with icy rich asteroids. If you look at the amount of accretion it took to build a planet as large as the Earth, then you look at a big collision, which, you know, the object which collided with us in that scenario to make the moon was subsumed mostly within the Earth itself. So that object was destroyed and you know, merged with, if you will, the growing Earth to become the Earth we see today. But just look at the surface of the moon, cratered and battered as it is. And then the features that you see on the as the man in the moon, if you will, the mare, the big seas, the big basins on the moon, hint. They're very deliberate statements to us of the giant impacts that were still occurring during that tail off process and accretion. It tells us that the Earth itself was battered very, very heavily during that time. Enough. When you add up all of that battering, it is an ocean's worth of water in just itself by looking at the typical amount of water contained in these primitive types of asteroids. That amount of battering to build the Earth in those late phases by itself was enough to deliver the Earth's oceans.
When we come back, Dan, I want to ask you if you think we've been visited from intelligence out there. I'll be back in a moment.